between the causes, consequences, prediction, and prevention of violence, which is considered a problem in public health and preventive medicine. Nor have most studied the principles on which the assessment of current and future dangerousness is based, regardless of whether any particular individual is mentally ill, and regardless of what diagnosis or diagnoses, if any, he may merit, according to the criteria outlined in DSM-5. That is why it is so important and so appropriate for those few of us who have done so, whether by investigating the psychology of Nazi doctors and Japanese terrorists, as Robert Lifton has done, or by studying sexual violence, rape, incest, etc., as Judith Herman has done, or by examining murderers and rapists, including those who have committed war crimes in prisons and jails throughout the world, as I did while working with the World Health Organization's Department of Violence and Injury Prevention on the epidemiology and prevention of violence, to warn the potential victims in the interests of public health when we recognize and identify signs and symptoms that indicate that someone is dangerous to the public health. One implication of this is that we need to identify the potential causes of injury and illness before they have harmed any given population of potential victims as severely or extensively as they would if allowed to go unchecked. In other words, we need to recognize the earliest signs of danger before they have expanded into a full-scale epidemic of lethal or life-threatening injury. The analogy here is to the proverb about how to get a frog to become unaware that it is being boiled to death. Place it in a pot of cold water, and then heat the water up bit by bit. Something analogous to that is the danger with the Trump presidency. The United States has been blessed with a little over two centuries of democracy. That is actually a rather short period in comparison with the millennia of monarchy. However, it is long enough to have made most of us complacent and perhaps overconfident with respect to the stability of our democracy. In fact, if we are prone to making a mistake in this regard, we are far more likely to underestimate the fragility of democracy than we are to become unnecessarily alarmist about it. Here again, it is the behavioral scientists who have studied violence, including but not limited to psychiatrists, who owe it to the public to share what we have learned before we experience the epidemic of violence that would be unleashed by the collapse or undermining of the rule of law, the system of checks and balances, the freedom of the press, the independence and authority of the judiciary, the respect for facts, the unacceptability of deliberate lying, the prohibition on conflicts between a political leader's private interests and the public interest, and the even stronger prohibition on physically assaulting one's political rivals or opponents and threatening to imprison or even assassinate them. In other words, dictatorship, all of which have been characteristic of Donald Trump's public statements throughout his electoral campaign and presidency. To wait until the water reaches boiling temperature, or our democracy collapses, before we begin saying anything about the fact that the water is warming already, would mean that anything we said or did in the future would come too late to be of any help. Let us not make the same mistake that the German Psychiatric Association did in the 1930s. There is an unfortunate and unnecessary taboo in the social and behavioral sciences generally against regarding politics and politicians as appropriate and legitimate subjects for discussion, inquiry, and conclusions. On the contrary, if a psychiatrist or psychologist or any other behavioral scientist expresses an opinion that is relevant to the political debates that occur in our country, he is likely to be accused of being partisan rather than professional, or engaging in a discussion that is just political rather than scientific. I would argue that the opposite is true. At a time when more and more medical scientists are urging us to practice evidence-based medicine, isn't it even more important that we learn to practice evidence-based politics? But of course, we cannot do that unless we are willing to apply the methods and accumulated knowledge of all the social and behavioral sciences to this subject and to publicize the conclusions we reach so that all our fellow citizens, which means all our fellow voters, can benefit from the knowledge we have gained through our clinical, experimental, and epidemiological research into the causes and prevention of violence, concerning which data from politics and economics certainly figure prominently. Gilligan, 2011, Lee, Wexler, and Gilligan, 2014. If we are silent about the numerous ways in which Donald Trump has repeatedly threatened violence, incited violence, or boasted about his own violence. We are passively supporting and enabling the dangerous and naive mistake of treating him as if he were a normal president or a normal political leader. He is not. And it is our duty to say so, and to say it publicly. He is unprecedentedly and abnormally dangerous. This is not to inform the public of something it does not already know, for most people in the lay public already appear to know it. Most voters voted against Trump. As our most recent Nobel Prize winner in literature, Bob Dylan, has put it, "You don't have to be a weatherman to know which way the wind is blowing." In fact, Trump's dangerousness is so obvious that he might be said to have preempted the role other people might otherwise have to play in warning the public as to how dangerous he is. For in his many public statements on that subject, he himself has warned us about how dangerous he is far more clearly and eloquently than we have been able to do or need to do. Our role here is not so much to warn the public ourselves, but merely to heed the warnings Trump himself has already given us, and to remind the public about them. In that regard, one final clarification is in order. Trump is now the most powerful head of state in the world, and one of the most impulsive, arrogant, ignorant, disorganized, chaotic, nihilistic, self-contradictory, self-important, and self-serving. He has his finger on the triggers of 1,000 or more of the most powerful thermonuclear weapons in the world. That means he could kill more people in a few seconds than any dictator in past history has been able to kill during his entire years in power. Indeed, by virtue of his office, Trump has the power to reduce the unprecedentedly destructive world wars and genocides of the 20th century to minor footnotes in the history of human violence. To say merely that he is dangerous is debatable only in the sense that it may be too much of an understatement. If he even took a step in this direction, we will not be able to say that he did not warn us loudly, clearly, and repeatedly. In that case, the fault will not be his alone. It will also be ours.
James Gilligan, M.D., is clinical professor of psychiatry and adjunct professor of law at New York University. He is a renowned violence studies expert and author of the influential Violence, Our Deadly Epidemic and Its Causes, as well as Preventing Violence and Why Some Politicians Are More Dangerous Than Others. He has served as director of mental health services for the Massachusetts Prisons and Prison Mental Hospital, president of the International Association for Forensic Psychotherapy, and as a consultant to President Clinton, Tony Blair, Kofi Annan, the World Court, the World Health Organization, and the World Economic Forum. A clinical case for the dangerousness of Donald J. Trump. Diane Zhuek, LMHC, DMHP. Mental illness in a U.S. president is not necessarily something that is dangerous for the citizenry he or she governs. A comprehensive study of all 37 U.S. presidents up to 1974 determined that nearly half of them had a diagnosable mental illness, including depression, anxiety, and bipolar disorder. Notably, however, personality disorders were not included in this study, even though they can be just as debilitating. This addition would most certainly have increased the number of presidents with mental illness to something well past 50%. Yet psychiatric illness alone in a president is not what causes grave concern. A second and crucial part of the equation is the president dangerous by reason of mental illness? Favoring civil liberties, U.S. law gives a lot of latitude for behavioral variation. When the law allows, even requires, that mental health professionals and physicians detain people against their will for psychiatric reasons, they must demonstrate that those people are a danger to themselves or others, or are gravely disabled. Initially, we need to look at what it means to be a danger to others due to mental illness. It is important to separate mental symptoms from things such as poor judgment or opinions and points of view that differ from one's own, which the law clearly permits. In the United States, it must be a disturbance of cognition, emotion regulation, or behavior, as described in the 5th edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorder, DSM-V, that is driving the patterns of dangerous behavior. Additionally, the magnitude of the perceived harm must be considered. Is it that feelings are being hurt, or is there actual damage being perpetrated? Are there patterns of behavior and statements of intent that reasonably indicate that harm is imminent? Does the person carry weapons or any other instruments of harm? People holding high political office inevitably cause some form of harm, whether they intend to or not. Leaders must often select what they think are the best options from a list of bad ones in areas as complex as military policy, the allocation of limited resources, or the line between safety nets and deregulation. When an individual in high office makes decisions, some people may be hurt in some way because of the sheer magnitude of that individual's power. A good leader will attempt, to the extent he or she can, to minimize that harm and to comfort those impacted, but damage is still unavoidable. This remains an unfortunate effect of governing large groups of people. This is also the very reason it is more, not less, important that the leader of the United States be mentally and emotionally stable. As president, Donald J. Trump has control over our executive branch and its agencies, is commander-in-chief of our military, has unilateral authority to fire nuclear weapons, which the Secretary of Defense authenticates but cannot veto. For the leader of the free world, inappropriate words alone may create a snowball effect that ultimately results in devastating harm to others. The MacArthur Violence Risk Assessment Study has a number of indicators for whether an individual will commit future violence. Some examples include a past history of violence, a criminal or substance abusing father, personal chemical abuse, having a generally suspicious nature, and a high score on the Novico Anger Scale. In regard to categories of mental health disorder, and perhaps counterintuitively, major illnesses, such as schizophrenia, have a lower rate of harm to others than personality disorders. Psychopathy, antisocial personality disorder, as measured by a screening version of the Hare Psychopathy Checklist, was more strongly associated with violence than any other risk factor we studied. Monahan, 2001. The 20-item Hare Checklist measures interpersonal and affective presentation, social deviance, impulsive lifestyle, and antisocial behavior. The president, in a position of great power and making critical decisions, should theoretically meet higher standards of mental stability. Also, having access to a nuclear arsenal capable of destroying the world many times over, he should be of lower risk of violence than the average citizen. Despite these higher standards, our response is the opposite, for there is protection of public perception to consider. The president is supposed to be our protector, and he is unwell and harmful. The more unwell and unwilling to admit of any disturbance in an extreme case scenario, the more a mental health detention may need to be considered, and how would that appear to the public? Or, if we did not act, would we continue to deny until we were at a point of no return? Additionally, those who dare apply these mental health principles, such as those who dare apply justice to our first citizen, may find themselves at risk of their jobs, their security, or even their personal safety by the president or that segment of our society currently feeling empowered by the rise of the present regime, who would be driven around the emotional bend if these actions were successful. A complex web of factors requires consideration, which is why public education and collaboration with other professionals, for example, politicians, lawyers, social psychologists, is highly important. There is a preponderance of information in the public record regarding Donald J. Trump's aberrant behavior. The following list of incidents is neither all-inclusive nor deeply analytical. Each topic is a potential theme for an entire book in its own right. The intent here is to isolate enough indicators of record to reach a reasoned conclusion about whether President Trump's patterns of behavior indicates a clinically relevant danger to others. During a rally in Wilmington, North Carolina, Trump stated, "Hillary wants to abolish, essentially abolish the Second Amendment. And by the way, if she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although, for the Second Amendment people, maybe there is. I don't know." A reporter covering this incident was moved to say, "While the remark was characteristically glib, it finds Trump again encouraging violence at his rallies. Worse, it marks a harrowing jump from threatening protesters to suggesting either an armed revolt or the assassination of a president." It was not just journalists who heard Trump's statement in these terms. The former head of the CIA, retired General Michael Hayden, told CNN's Jake Tapper, "If someone else had said that outside the hall, he'd be in the back of a police wagon now with the Secret Service questioning him." It is true also for medical and mental health professionals. If a patient had said that, an emergency certificate would have been signed, and the person taken to the nearest emergency room for further questioning and evaluation. Trump has said that he did not mean the statement the way it sounded. A common explanation by his defenders of aggressive and untoward remarks made by him in public settings is that what he said was a joke. This in no way discounts the dangerousness of his remark. In fact, his deeming the remark so lightly as to consider that it could be a joke would in itself be concerning. Moreover, his holding life and death matters themselves to be inconsequential may indicate serious pathology and risk, which cannot fully be ruled out without a detailed examination. This statement, in this context, exemplifies the willingness to violate others and the lack of empathy that characterize antisocial personality disorder. In modern history, no other candidate for president of the United States has joked about his followers murdering his opponent. In his response to the release by the Washington Post of the now infamous "Grab 'em by the Pussy" video, Trump, the candidate, stated that the audio was recorded more than 10 years ago and did not represent who he is. The recording was made by Access Hollywood's Billy Bush on September 16, 2005. It includes the following comments from the newly married Trump when he sees actress Arianne Zucker outside the bus where he is being recorded. "I better use some Tic Tacs, just in case I start kissing her." Sound of Tic Tacs being dispensed. "You know I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. Just kiss. I don't even wait." Farentold, 2016. During the course of the video, he is on record as saying even more disturbing and assaultive things regarding women. After this video was aired, a significant number of Republican senators, representatives, governors, political appointees, and others stated publicly that they would not endorse Trump for office. Lisa Murkowski, Republican senator from Alaska, stated, "The video that surfaced yesterday further revealed his true character," she said. "He not only objectified women, he bragged about preying upon them. I cannot and will not support Donald Trump for president. He has forfeited the right to be our party's nominee. He must step aside." Brian Sandoval, Republican governor from Nevada, declared, "This video exposed not just words, but now an established pattern, which I find to be repulsive and unacceptable for a candidate for president of the United States." While senators and representatives have a more complicated relationship to Trump as president, governors and political appointees are more removed from him politically and warrant closer inspection. Of note, With less to lose politically, both these groups had a higher percentage of members state that they would not endorse Trump. Of the 15 Republican governors who went on record, 53% stated that they would not endorse the nominee for president. Two of the seven who said they would endorse him now have jobs in his administration as vice president and United Nations ambassador. Of the 23 Republican political appointees who made statements on record, an astounding 87% of them said they would not endorse or vote for Trump. Only three said they would. Therapists of mental health across the country report having to expand their practices to include what is being called election trauma. What I'm seeing with my clients, particularly with women who experienced sexual abuse when younger, is that they are being re-wounded, re-traumatized, said Atlanta-licensed professional counselor Susan Blank. They can't escape it. It's all around them, written large on the national scale. Among the many truly disturbing behaviors of this man now serving as the leader of the free world is his relationship to his daughter Ivanka. What follows are some of the more unsettling things Trump has said about her while knowingly being recorded.
You know who's one of the great beauties of the world, according to everybody? And I helped create her. Ivanka. My daughter Ivanka. She's 6 feet tall. She's got the best body.
During an interview with Howard Stern when Ivanka was 22 years old,
I've said that if Ivanka weren't my daughter, perhaps I'd be dating her.
And in another appearance on the Howard Stern radio show, in response to Stern's saying, by the way, your daughter, Trump responded, she's beautiful. Stern added, can I say this? A piece of ass. To which Trump replied,
yeah.
To a reporter about Ivanka.
Yeah, she's really something. And what a beauty, that one. If I weren't happily married and, you know, her father.
On Fox's Wendy Williams show in 2013,
Ivanka, what's the favorite thing you have in common with your father?
Williams asked. Either real estate or golf, Ivanka replied.
Donald?
Williams asked Trump.
Well, I was going to say sex, but I can't relate that to.
Trump answers, gesturing to Ivanka. One of the first acts of mass citizen resistance against Trump's presidency occurred the day after his inauguration, when much of the country went to the streets in protest. The 2017 Women's March was the largest protest gathering in the history of the United States. Researchers Jeremy Pressman and Erica Chenoweth, 2017, estimate that more than 4 million people participated nationwide. They calculate that approximately 300,000 people marched in other countries, partly in response to an assaultive attitude and behavior against women unprecedented in a U.S. president. A great danger to vulnerable groups and the potential for human rights abuses arise from the type of individuals Trump's psychopathy leads him to look to for affirmation and support. Unable to tolerate criticism and perceived threats to his ego, and with a documented obsessive need to be admired, he has notably selected as his advisors either family members or people who, in clinical jargon, enable his illness. This is one of the more significant ways in which he has become a danger to others as president. Members of vulnerable communities often write and speak about grave concerns regarding those whom he is choosing to guide him. Using his proposed federal budget as a lens, Jessica Gonzalez Rojas writes, it outlines President Trump's spending priorities and program cuts that make clear his utter contempt for communities of color, and it edges this country and its moral compass closer to the nativist vision espoused by the likes of White House advisors Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller, and Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
His mental health systems, including impulsive blame shifting, claims of unearned superiority, and delusional levels of grandiosity, have been present in his words from his very first campaign speech.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. I would build a great wall, and nobody builds walls better than me, believe me, and I'll build them very inexpensively. I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall. Mark my words.
Regarding U.S. District Judge Gonzalo Curiel, who was born in Indiana, Trump claimed it was a conflict of interest for the judge to hear a fraud case against Trump University, telling CNN, "He's a Mexican. We're building a wall between here and Mexico." Trump's unhinged response to court decisions, driven as they appear to be by paranoia, delusion, and a sense of entitlement, are of grave concern. While President of the United States, he has on more than one occasion questioned the legitimacy of the court, as in this example.
"We will have a very smooth rollout," he insisted, claiming that the only problem with the Muslim ban was the bad court that halted it.
In February 2017, he tweeted, "The opinion of this so-called judge, which essentially takes law enforcement away from our country, is ridiculous and will be overturned." To which Representative Jerry Nadler responded on February 8, 2017, "At Real Donald Trump's conduct, attacking judges and undermining independent judiciary, is inappropriate and dangerous." According to the Department of Homeland Security, at least 721 individuals and their families were denied the entry they had expected at U.S. borders under a ban soon deemed illegal by more than one court. At least 100,000 visas were revoked, according to a Justice Department lawyer. "We're hearing from really, really scared people," said Rachel Tiven, CEO of Lambda Legal, a nonprofit legal advocacy organization for LGBTQ rights. She adds, "We're seeing a fear of an atmosphere of intolerance that began with Trump's campaign." In the same article, Chris Hayashi, executive director of the Transgender Law Center, states, "It was clear in 2016 that we saw an upswing in anti-trans legislation, more than we'd ever seen before. We anticipated that was not going to lessen, but increase in 2017. These are situations that put fear not just into the individual who is targeted, but the entire community," said Heidi Byrich, director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's SPLC Intelligence Project, in a Boston Globe article about increased hate-based crimes at schools in Massachusetts. The SPLC reports that a record 16,720 complaints were filed nationwide with the Office for Civil Rights of the U.S. Department of Education in 2016, which they state is a 61% increase over the previous year. The American Association of University Professors National Council has approved the following resolution. "Since the election of Donald J. Trump almost 2 weeks ago, the U.S. has experienced an unprecedented spike in hate crimes, both physical and verbal, many of them on college and university campuses. These have been directed against African Americans, immigrants, members of the LGBTQ community, religious minorities, women, and people with disabilities. In some instances, the perpetrators have invoked the president-elect in support of their heinous actions." Within the resolution, the council affirms the concept of free speech, stating, "No viewpoint or message may be deemed so hateful or disturbing that it may not be expressed, but threats and harassment differ from expressions of ideas that some or even most may find repulsive. They intimidate and silence."
Two social psychologists at the University of Kansas conducted a study on prejudice that involved surveying an even split of 400 Trump and Clinton supporters. The scientists noted that Trump's campaign over the preceding 18 months featured a procession of racist and ethnocentric rhetoric, with repeated insults, gross generalizations, and other derogatory speech hurled at Mexicans, Muslims, and women. So they asked 100 of the Trump and 100 of the Clinton supporters to rate their personal feelings toward a variety of social groups that the Trump campaign had disparaged at one time or another over the course of the race: Muslims, immigrants, Mexicans, fat people, and people with disabilities. All study participants were also polled on groups that Trump had not publicly maligned: alcoholics, adult film stars, rich people, members of the National Rifle Association, and Canadians. When the participants were surveyed again after the election, Crandall and White found that both personal and general prejudices remained unchanged for both sets of supporters with regard to the groups that Trump had not publicly targeted. But for the groups that Trump had disparaged, both Trump and Clinton supporters reported slightly lower levels of personal animus and significantly higher levels of perceived acceptance for discriminatory speech. In short, the perceived norm had shifted. Research suggests that individual expressions of prejudice and potential violence depend highly on perceived social norms. Trump surely had the effect of changing those norms. Sometimes overlooked is the extent to which this president's mental health issues are harming our children. His impact is pervasive enough to have earned a label, the Trump effect. It has been used specifically to describe the trauma American children are experiencing because of Trump's candidacy and now presidency. We have a bully in our midst, some therapists and school counselors say, traumatizing the most vulnerable of us. That bully is the 2016 presidential campaign, including the so-called Trump effect. SBLC Teaching Tolerance Director Maureen Costello has said, "I'm concerned children are coming to school every day terrified, anxious, disappointed, fearful, feeling unwanted." As the issue of Trump's mental illness was not of intense national concern until he ran for office and assumed the presidency, assessment by individuals with intimate understanding of what that job entails are useful for analyzing his dangerousness. It is instructive to remove the variable of political ideology from our determination and narrow our review to the perspective of Republicans only. In August 2016, a letter signed by 50 such individuals was published in the New York Times. While some of their concern centers on lack of experience, a portion of the letter made more direct reference to Trump's mental and emotional stability. "The undersigned individuals have all served in senior national security and/or foreign policy positions in Republican administrations, from Richard Nixon to George W. Bush. We have worked directly on national security issues with these Republican presidents and/or their principal advisors during wartime and other periods of crisis, through successes and failures. We know the personal qualities required of a president of the United States. None of us will vote for Donald Trump. From a foreign policy perspective, Donald Trump is not qualified to be president and commander-in-chief. Indeed, we are convinced that he would be a dangerous president and would put at risk our country's national security and well-being. A president," they continue, "must be willing to listen to his advisors and department heads, must encourage consideration of conflicting views, and must acknowledge errors and learn from them, must be disciplined, control emotions, and act only after reflection and careful deliberation, must maintain cordial relationships with leaders of countries of different backgrounds and must have their respect and trust, and must be able and willing to separate truth from falsehood in order to aspire to be president and commander-in-chief with command of the U.S. nuclear arsenal.
They conclude, "We are convinced that in the Oval Office, he would be the most reckless president in American history." Hillary Clinton's remark, "A man you can bait with a tweet is not a man we can trust with nuclear weapons," was not just campaign hyperbole. The President of the United States has approximately 2,000 deployed nuclear warheads at his or her disposal, and has the authority to order these weapons to be launched, even if our country has not yet been attacked. Weapons fired against the United States from a submarine would take about 12 minutes to hit Washington, D.C. Missiles fired from most continents would reach this country in about 30 minutes. The nightmare scenario of this unstable, impulsive, blame-shifting, and revenge-obsessed individual having mere minutes to make the kind of decision required in such a scenario is of the gravest concern possible in our era. In an interview on Fox News, then-Vice President Dick Cheney stated, "He, the president, could launch a kind of devastating attack the world's never seen. He doesn't have to check with anybody. He doesn't have to call the Congress. He doesn't have to check with the courts. He has that authority because of the nature of the world we live in." The entire focus in the missile launch decision process is on whether the launch command is authentic, not whether it is reasonable. Ron Rosenbaum describes the case of Major Harold Herring, who, during the period when Nixon was displaying erratic behavior, was troubled by a question he was not allowed to ask. Major Herring decided to ask his question anyway, regardless of consequences. How could he know that an order to launch his missiles was lawful, that it came from a sane president, one who wasn't imbalanced or berserk, as Major Herring's lawyer eventually colorfully put it? Herring was a career military officer and asked the question while attending a missile training class. He was discharged from the Air Force for asking it. To this day, Harold Herring's question remains unanswered. If we who have come together to write this book are accurate in our assessments, one must ask why Donald J. Trump's dangerousness was not addressed earlier in his life. The extensive public record on him shows that he has been insulated by inherited wealth and that his father had similar mental health disturbances. As we are all witnessing now, with his politically inexperienced daughter and son-in-law taking key advisory positions at the White House, Trump has distanced himself from possible checks and balances while enabling his own disorder, a lack of insight and confirmation-seeking that makes certain mental disorders particularly dangerous in a position of power. A substantive change in the level of his dangerousness came with his assumption of the role of leader of the free world. Although an argument can be made that, by taking this office, he has shaken the global political structure to the extent that the U.S. presidency is rapidly losing that standing. His narcissistic traits, manifesting in blatant lying, impulsive and compulsive decision-making against rational interests, and immature relational abilities, are creating a leadership gap that other political actors may well seek to fill. Yet, it is impossible for him, through the lens of his mental dysfunction, to evaluate his actual presentation and impact. As the ultimate representative of our nation, Donald J. Trump is normalizing previously outrageous behaviors, negatively impacting everyone from leaders of other nations to our own children. From the outset of his presidency, although clearly absent a mandate from the population he now governs, he has repeatedly declared himself the greatest, or tremendous, or knowing more than anyone, and other statements consistent with narcissistic personality disorder, with regard to an expectation of being viewed as superior without commensurate achievements. He exhibits extreme denial of any feedback that does not affirm his self-image and psychopathic tendencies, which affords him very limited ability to learn and effectively adjust to the requirements of the office of president.
Rather, he consistently displays a revenge-oriented response to any such feedback. Holding this office at once feeds his grandiosity and claws at the fragile sense of self underneath it. His patterns of behavior while in the role of President of the United States have potentially dire impact on every individual living not only in this nation, but across the entire globe. The Earth itself is in peril, both from the urgent issues that are not being addressed while an unstable man sits in the Oval Office, and by the new urgencies he creates. Mr. Trump is, and has demonstrated himself to be, a danger to others, not just one person or a few, but possibly to all others. Diane Jueck, LMHC, DMHP, has operated a private therapy practice for several decades. In addition, she performs mental health evaluations and detentions on individuals presenting as a danger to self or others. In a previous social justice career, she was a women's specialist at the United Nations in New York City. She founded the Women's and Children's Free Restaurant, an empowerment project that has been in operation for 30 years. She also founded the People's AIDS Project and was an assistant regional manager for Feeding America. She has directed agencies addressing food aid, domestic violence, apartheid, low-income housing, and LGBTQ rights.
Health, risk, and the duty to protect the community. Howard H. Kovitz, Ph.D., ABPP. Don't go loose-lipped among your people, but don't stand idly by either as your neighbor bleeds. I am God. Leviticus 19:16. That's my own translation from the Hebrew. A literal take on this passage might be, go not rumoring among your people. Stand not on the blood of your neighbor. I am God. This collected volume of essays is about the investigation of a tension between two goods, a balancing act that is at least as old as the Bible. Leviticus argues for a version of confidentiality that is almost unlimited. Don't go loose-lipped among your people. Indeed, the psalmist would specify further, who is the man who desires life? Guard your tongue against speaking ill and your lips against uttering gossip. Psalms 34:12. Looking back to the Leviticus text, we see that an exception is immediately rendered, as there would be times when speaking up was necessary to protect another from harm. In traditional cantillation, the halfway melody mark of the sentence, es nachta, is immediately before I am God. The intent of the ancient writer seems to be, oh, yes, there is a tension between confidentiality and the duty to warn, and recognizing this tension holds the essence of godliness, or goodness, as we might say today. And after two or three millennia, the mental health community is just beginning to recognize this dialectic. This, indeed, is the dialogue that developed within the community of practitioners during and after the 2016 U.S. presidential election. This tension is known as the one between the Goldwater Rule, which protects a limited privacy for public figures, and the duty to warn those who may be at risk of serious harm from the same public figures. At least three complexities stand in the way of offering up a simple solution. Are mental health professionals duty-bound to speak their truth about a presidential candidate's fitness for duty? Or should they, rather, be constrained by professional ethics from doing so? What are the measurements by which we evaluate the first? What are the injuries of its absence? Is it a matter of a personal decision or a decision by the community in which one lives? The second difficulty has to do with the following. When we investigate the wellness of an individual, are we focused on his freedom from disabling characteristics that compromise his own life? Or, rather, do we concern ourselves with whether he is a danger to himself or others? Finally, we will briefly turn to how we evaluate risk, whether publicly shared or not. Two types of mental illness. More than 80 years ago, in a polemic against religion and political-based theories, Freud asked, "Does psychoanalysis lead toward a particular Weltanschauung?" Freud, Sprott and Strachey, 1933, page 158. Answering this question in the negative, Freud chose empirical science over what he considered to be illusion and emotion. His new psychotherapies would, if Freud had his way, rely on no assumptions whatever about the good life, but solely on scientific methodology and clear-minded examination of the observable. While this may seem perfectly reasonable, let me point out that the sciences, as is the case with the purest of them all, mathematics, depend not only on the correctness of the investigator's logical moves, but also on the postulates or axioms we begin with. Let me then state my own position. While in the natural sciences, it is assumed that researches and classification systems are generally independent of values, in the psychological and social sciences, such theoretical neatness is a luxury. Psychological theories of health are inextricably intertwined with the views of a healthy polity, with the need to protect the community, and with a vision of the good life. When we apply knowledge from one group to another, we speak of an error of cultural bias. Even science cannot be thoroughly free of assumptions and values. Whatever paradigms one selects for describing mental health and mental illness, there will be questions of how the individual processes feelings, thoughts, and actions. Consider, for instance, anxiety. Humankind has developed anxiety as an adaptive signal to the body to prepare for danger, danger from another person or from a feral predator. However, if the anxiety expresses itself in eating disorders or digestive failure or in facial tics, we see it as maladaptive. Similar constructions can be offered for other responses, such as depression, anger, guilt, and shame. On the other side is the arguable value in examining mental structures that foster civilized behavior and a capacity for non-destructive membership in polities of mutual concern. These two are adaptive and promote wellness both in the individual and in groups. These two perspectives are joined in a three-part definition of emotional health. The healthy person has the capacity to recognize his own wishes and impulses and those of others with clarity, the ability to determine whether the actions that express these impulses are likely to cause avoidable damage to himself or others, and when such actions or speech are deemed safe, and the agency necessary to act upon those impulses without intrusive anger, anxiety, depression, guilt, prohibition, or shame. Those who either are incapable of or disinterested in measuring the impact they may have on another or on others may well appear symptom-free, functional, and at times even quite successful in their work lives, but they are typically not so in their relationships. In very general terms, those who suffered internally were thought to be living with symptomatic disturbances, while the latter group was described as having character pathology or personality disorders. Here, too, our discussion gets more than a little messy. As noted earlier, what constitutes healthy interpersonal relationships varies from culture to culture. Perhaps a recognition of this messiness contributed to the unwillingness of some mental health professionals to define what is meant by a healthy individual or a well community. And here, too, we cannot escape making certain postulates about the good life. Freud focused on the puzzling development of conscience. He reasoned that the child begins life with a sense that all are present to serve him. A youngster eventually recognizes that others exist, but not initially that they are complex beings with their own thoughts and relationships. Freud discovered that the child's life changes dramatically when he realizes that others are subjects, just as he is. Subjects in their own right. Kovitz, 2016. Until that time, the child understands others more or less only in their capacities to satisfy his needs, as either good or bad, as satisfying his demands or not. When the child accepts the complexity of family relationships and is able to understand that mom and dad have an independent relationship, he has begun to embrace them as subjects, as doers, with their own thoughts, feelings, and relationships. He has, Freud would say, developed a conscience, an Über-Ich, or a guiding eye. Those who fail to accept others as subjects in their own right comprise the personality disordered subgroup of humanity. Let me be a little more specific as to the typical characteristics seen in personality disordered individuals. 1. Such people are generally incapable of understanding and responding in an emotionally empathic way to how another feels. They may well, in an intellectual way, be able to know how others react or even what they might be thinking, but this has little bearing on how they treat others, who remain objects to them, like pieces on a chessboard to be moved about in order to win the game. 2. This black-and-white thinking effectively splits the world into friend or foe, into those who support him and all those who are against him. Such a person may, indeed, grow to be incapable of bigotry, for to be bigoted or racist or sexist, one must feel allegiance to a group. Still and all, they may have no qualms about using bigotries for their own purposes. 3. Lacking the need to evaluate how their actions may impact others, these people react more quickly and with less skepticism about the correctness of their actions. 4. Such individuals have not yet developed respect for others' thinking, relationships, or efforts, which leads them to put little value in the accomplishments of others. As such, they tend not to recognize the necessity for maintaining extant organizations, government structures, conventional practices, and laws. They may appear civilized, but are not safely socialized. 5. Due to the aforementioned, points 1 through 4, their thinking is focused, but lacks nuance. They demonstrate no apparent ability to see more than one not unreasonable view, a monomania of sorts. These views, additionally, can flip to their opposite, since what makes any new attitude acceptable to them is under the control of a "my will be done" syndrome, no matter what that will is. 6. Finally, following on 1 through 5, they display a limited capacity to distinguish the real from the wished for or imagined, and demonstrate a ready willingness to distort the truth. 2 fables. There are 2 distinct general types of emotional illness, those that precipitate symptoms in the individual and those that represent a risk to relationships and the communities in which the person lives. This leads directly into our second concern. Is the mental health of a powerful leader to be measured by the person's relationship to oneself or by one's ability to be safe and constructive in a polity of mutual concern? I'll ask the reader to imagine 2 fables and some thought experiments. Fable 1, The Policeman. I was driving down Old York Road in my police cruiser when I saw this driver, a funny-looking kind of old guy. He was driving his brand-new Bentley, so I assumed he was pretty safe, even though he was weaving just a little haphazardly, you know, a little erratic. He had his window open and was calling some immigrant-looking pedestrians pretty angry names. I pulled him over. He had a small arsenal of automatic weapons up front and what looked like an RPG launcher on the back seat. I asked him, "What's with all the weapons, sir?" He says, "Officer, I've got a license and Montgomery County is open carry. I have every right to go where I want." Anyhow, it's a pretty dangerous world out there. You know, there are a lot of immigrants, and I think I saw Muslims dancing in Wall Park. I go back to my cruiser and call the station house. Sarge, any report of dancing foreigners in the park? Sarge asks me what I've been smoking. I understand his intent. So I go back to the guy's car. Sir, I cannot confirm any disturbance going on in Wall Park. Officer, I saw it myself, and I should know because I have a lot of money. The man then goes on and on talking trash about people who are different, saying that everybody who disagrees with him is a liar, and one of them might have killed a Kennedy, and another one should be sent to the Women's Detention Center because she's the world's biggest crook. Then he tells me it's not raining and that it never rains when he's riding in his Bentley. Meanwhile, the water's pouring off Miss Stetson. He starts swearing about the township commissioners and accusing them of being stupid. In any case, I have choices, don't I? I think to myself, I could say any of the following. 1. Sir, you be careful now and have a blessed day. 2. Sir, I just want to say that your car is the tiger's roar. Be careful now. 3. Sir, I think you might be batshit crazy, but I can't be sure, so have a good day. 4. Sir, take me for a ride in your car, please, and give me a good job, and we'll forget about all this silliness. Or, 5. Sir, would you step out of the car and we'll take a ride and see if we can't settle down those images in your head of Muslims dancing in the park? By the way, were they barefoot? Fable 2. The Casual Customer and the Man in the Psychotherapist's Office. A person comes into my psychoanalytic office, or, for that matter, sits down next to me at Starbucks carrying a small caliber handgun. I ask the reader to imagine that, in listening to him, I recognize the 6 characteristics I've just described. In any case, imagine further that time is up on our meeting or that our coffee is finished. I've not administered any objective tests. The man shows no signs of anxiety. He has only expressed disdain for others and assuredly no shame or guilt. He seems to be oriented in time and space. Still, I have a strong, if tentative, diagnostic impression that this man suffers from serious character disorders. What shall I do? And what is my ethical duty to do as a citizen, and or as a citizen possessing special training? But back to President Trump. I've gone back in my mind to Leviticus time after time since the election. It occurred to me more than once that the behaviors of candidate, president-elect, and now President Trump may have been, as is the case with the television persona Stephen Colbert presented for many years, an act. As a psychologist and psychoanalyst with more than 40 years of experience, I cannot say with certainty, for instance, whether Trump's sexist comments and claims of sexual acting out, his unempathic responses to the cons who'd lost their soldier son overseas, or to a handicapped man at his rally, or his calls for violence at those rallies were no more than performance art. Perhaps, in his heart of hearts, I thought, Mr. Trump has an empathic soul, does not split the world into with him and against him groups, and is a careful and nuanced thinker. Perhaps, even, Mr. Trump knows the difference between alternate reality and reality, and perhaps he simply uses alternate reality as a strategic ploy. I did consider this and concluded, nonetheless, that his actions still showed severe gaps. After all, and briefly, the damage to the cons was done. The lies were believed by tens of millions of Trump's followers. Violent rhetoric at his meetings produced real harm, and Mr. Trump has irresponsibly alienated, so far, 5 of our closest trading partners. The simple arithmetic of risk management. Since the attack on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon of September 11, 2001, the leaders in the United States and other nation states have communicated to their citizens the need to be vigilant. George W. Bush advocated repeatedly our need to go on living our lives, walking about freely, and carrying out the tasks of living, working, and shopping that preceded the many terrorist attacks the world has come to know as, more or less, weekly events. In addition, however, President Bush and others have advocated that we all remain vigilant. We are told that if we see a suspect package on a bus or airplane or at the Boston Marathon, or if we notice a suitcase left alone at an airport, we should immediately leave the area, warn others, and contact the police. Schools have since developed zero-tolerance rules requiring that if a student is heard speaking of violence toward himself or others, he must immediately be removed from the school and not reinstated until an expert deems him safe to return. Mathematicians use an intuitive construction that combines the probability of a negative outcome multiplied by the result of that negative outcome. For example, if the probability of losing a certain wager is 1% and would result in their losing $10, most people would feel